Coming up on 741 on the Mighty 690 as we go throughout a Wednesday edition of the program, and that means we have the folks from K-State Research and Extension's Wildcat District in studio. We have Food Safety and Nutrition Agent Holly Miner and Horticulture Agent Jesse Gilmore. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good to have you on here. So starting first with Holly, I know we've got, we've kind of gotten past one big holiday for, Thanksgiving and all that sort of thing, and we're really gearing up for another one and Christmas, and I know you wanted to talk a little bit about some of these homemade gifts.
That's right. So this time of year, we're making a lot of things that we save just for this time of year, right? A lot of those holiday cookies and candies and jams and jellies and different things, and a lot of people give those away as gifts. So we want to think about if we're shipping those items, how we're preparing them to be shipped, and making sure that they are safe. If there are things that we're shipping, like perishable foods, maybe a cheesecake that we've made that we want to ship to somebody that we love, that would be something that would be perishable. So we want to make sure that those foods are kept at frozen temperatures and shipped and received cold, below 41 degrees. So we want to make sure that we're thinking of how we're going to pack that item. Are we packing it in styrofoam or adding dry ice to it? When you pack gifts that need to be kept cold, if you put peanuts or the little styrofoam peanuts, or stuffed paper in them to take up the airspace if there's extra room in the box or the styrofoam container, that keeps the air out of the box, and that helps keep the item colder. Making sure that we're adding dry ice to it, which is an ice that does not melt and leave water like regular ice would do, because we don't want to ruin the food or the package. That is the best way to be able to ship those items. Shipping them overnight, checking out which carrier or freight company can ship overnight, making the best choice for that. Sometimes they'll have special packaging that you can use. There's a guarantee that that item will be shipped overnight. We also want to make sure that anything that we make is made in a safe way. So that we've taken our time, we washed our hands before we start preparing it. We've prepared it according to the recipe, especially if it's a jam or jelly, that we're using a safe source for that, that we've done everything like the recipe says, and that we've prepared it in a way that's going to make it safe when it is received to be eaten. Once an item is received that does need to be refrigerated, we need to make sure that we let the people that we're sending it to know that it's coming, so that they are there and can put it in the refrigerator or the freezer right away. If you are buying something from a retail store, so this is a great time to be able to it's a great time to be able to support your local business.
Sure, yeah.
By purchasing items from them and then having them ship, so that takes the shipping onus off of you and lets them be able to ship it, and they've shipped a lot of things, so they should be really good at shipping things that are food safety where that's a concern. So, but it's a great way to support your local retail businesses too. I know in the past I've received several things, meat items that have been frozen and received frozen, and so they do a really good job of packing and making sure that those things are safe. So we just want to make sure that when you're getting ready to give gifts this holiday season, that you're thinking about how those things are done. I've given gifts of jam and jelly in the past, and I've traveled, so I've taken them with me as I've traveled. And sometimes my travels make me stay overnight somewhere before I get to the person's house. And so if you're doing something like jam and jelly and you've packed that in your car, you want to make sure that you probably take that out into the hotel with you at night, so that it doesn't freeze, and pop the lids on the jars of jam and jelly when it freezes. So there's those considerations to take in mind as well.
If you pull them out of the car, would you want to put them in the fridge in the hotel room, assuming that your hotel room does have a fridge?
Well, if it's a jam or jelly, no, because they're already sealed correctly and safe to be on the shelf. You just don't want those items to freeze. If it's something that needs to stay cold and you know that the temperature is below freezing and it needs to stay frozen, then you could leave it in your car because it's going to stay cold in your car. So, yeah, great question, though, Jesse.
Well, and then the other thing is, you know, for some of those folks traveling via air travel, there may be some restrictions on, you know, like liquids and all that sort of thing. I don't know what the current TSA thinking is on jelly, you know, but you might want to check out some of those items there.
Yeah, that's a great point. I traveled recently in September, and I had a frozen water bottle, and I was trying to drink it, and it was still half frozen, and the TSA guy says, oh, don't worry about it, it's a solid. And I'm like,
technically correct.
Oh, man.
And so I got through with a half frozen bottle of water.
A logical organization.
So yes, it's probably best to call ahead and find out those kinds of restrictions or whether you can carry those things on.
You know, I do have a quick story from actually K-State. My roommate was going back. He's from New York, and he had bought the meat department. They've got their meat sale,
yes,
you know, for
yes.
Christmas, and so he bought a ham. And then he was going to travel via airplane back to New York. And so he actually contacted the meat manager there at the K-State meat lab and said, is there anything I should do to travel with this ham? And so he told him how to pack it, you know, just kind of like you've been uh-huh. talking about. And then, you know, he got to the airport and they said, is there anything, you know, liquid, fragile, perishable? And he's like, well, I do have a ham in my carry-on.
So, according to the TSA website, you can go through if your ice packs are completely frozen, but if there's any liquid, they won't let you through. But
yeah.
Frozen foods are allowed in both carry-on and checked bags.
Hmm.
Great information. Yeah, I think that's probably why I got through with my water bottle. I had drank all the water, and there's just a little bit of ice in it.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Of course, I'm not sure what people are going to do with a liquid water bottle, but you never know. I don't know. That's great.
Interesting things.
Anything else on this topic?
Well, you know, we are in the holiday season. People are going to be preparing their foods, and we talked a little bit about turkey for Thanksgiving. Well, a lot of people do hams, speaking of hams, for Christmas, and we just want to make sure that those are cooked through to the correct temperature. So make sure you get your food thermometer out and check that temperature. They should be 145 degrees when they're cooked. And we want to make sure that people are preparing their food safely. And, you know, it may not be cold enough to leave food set outside in between meals. So make sure you've got plenty of refrigerator room, clean your refrigerator out, and have room for all those wonderful, delicious dishes that need to be refrigerated after they're prepared.
That's a good reminder because, you know, a lot of people, especially when they got lots of people over, the garage and the back porch kind of turn into de facto refrigerators. But yeah, you gotta actually, because we're gonna be going up to an overnight low of 50 here in a couple nights, so yeah, that'd be a little bit too warm.
Yeah, 40 degrees, 41 degrees below that. So, you know, if you're if it's gonna be freezing outside, you're good, but if it's in the 40s or above 40, then you probably need to make sure that you have it in a place that's going to be colder than that. And you know, a lot of times your garage, you're going in and out of the garage, it gets warmer than the outside temperature, so keep that in mind as well. And then store those leftovers right away, you know, leave them only out on the counter to be served for 2 hours, and then at 2 hour time frame they need to be put in back into cold storage.
And you mentioned the hams. Are most of like the spiral cut hams, are those already cooked and we're just heating those up, or how does that typically work?
Yeah, so sometimes a lot of them are pre-cooked. Just make sure you're reading the package to see if it is a pre-cooked or if it's one that needs to be thoroughly heated through. Some of those pre-cooked hams, you can actually serve them cold. So, you know, read your package label, know what you're going to do, what else you're preparing in the oven. Maybe you don't have a lot of room for things in the oven, and a pre-cooked ham that you can serve cold is what you want to do. So I've been at a dinner where we've done that before, and it's a little bit different because you think your ham should be hot. So it was a little bit different eating cold ham, but yeah.
Always good to know on that. So Jesse.
Holly, I know you love encouraging people to use the Ball Blue Book when developing recipes for preserved, it is all types of preserved food, right? Not just jams and jellies. Are there any flavors that would be seasonal right about now to look for in that book?
Yeah, so pepper jelly is one that I think a lot of people have at the holiday time. So that's just, it's a jelly that's made with bell peppers and jalapeno peppers. And the Ball Blue Book does have a great recipe for jalapeno pepper jelly. So, and you can make it green, orange, or yellow. So those are all good holiday colors. So that is a good one. There's also spiced apple rings, which are just apples that have cinnamon and I believe it's cloves in them. And so that's another good holiday recipe, a fun one to do. A lot of people do watermelon pickles, which have cinnamon in them, all of those. But when we want to make sure that we are using a recipe from a tested and safe source. So the National Center for Home Food Preservation is a great website to go to, and it has all different kinds of recipes in it. You can search for a recipe, and that would be your best source of canning recipes that is from a safe source. Also, the USDA has the Complete Guide to Home Canning, and any publication that has a .edu on it. So like K-State publications are .edu publications, or those websites would be great sources for food preservation books. The Ball Blue Book is another one that we recommend. And then the So Easy to Preserve book, which is put out by the University of Georgia Extension.
So I do have one final question. As someone who is not overly familiar with food preservation, let's say that you've got an old family recipe that, you know, has been passed down for generations of a specific type of preserved food, but you don't know that it is 100% safe as far as preparation and the technique. Is there a way to get that recipe tested to make sure that it is safe and approved for food safety reasons? Like, for example, if you were wanting to use that recipe in a commercial kitchen or, like, sell at a farmer's market.
So if you are preparing a food that you're going to sell, there's a better controls processing school that needs to be completed. You need to get a certification to be able to do that, and then you send your recipe in, very specific, in to have it tested, and that process has to be followed exactly to the T. It's a very thorough testing that goes into that to make sure that the pH is high enough, and there's just a lot of things that go into that. I just recently took that class, and so there's a lot of detail that goes into that process, and it's not an inexpensive process. It's every recipe that you have tested could cost up to $200 to $400. So, ooh, wow. If you're going to do that, it's something that you really need to make sure that you're following the correct protocol for.
You probably want to be someone who has customers ready for your recipe before.
Does that include like the calorie information and all that breakdown? Is it
information?
What point do you have to cross that threshold?
Yes, that would, because it is going to be sold, it does have a nutrition label with ingredient listing on it, and you can get it a little more detailed if you want to, but foods that are sold that you've prepared at home that you're selling need to have a label on them, where they're manufactured at, who manufactured them, what the item is, and then a list of ingredients, and especially any of those ingredients that might be an allergen for people. So all of those things, that's a whole nother topic. We could spend a long time talking about labeling and those kinds of things. But Jesse, you also mentioned grandma's pickle recipe or whatever home, you know, whatever recipe that's been passed down through the generations. And for the general home canner, we want to make sure that any recipe that we're using is from a tested source. And so if there's a recipe that's been passed down from generation to generation, the best thing to do with that recipe would be to find one exactly like it in a tested recipe source, or a source that we know is safe. If you cannot find one that's exactly like it in a safe source, then I would not use it as a canning recipe, but maybe as a refrigerator pickling recipe or something like that.
All righty. Well, Holly, if people have questions for you, what's the best way to get a hold of you?
They can give me a call at 620-331-2690, or they can email me at haminer, like the National Miners Day with an E-R, at ksu.edu.
Okay, and Jesse, what do we have coming up on our next segment?
We're going to be talking a little bit about how to select plants for winter and summer hardiness, and the recent update to the USDA hardiness zone for Kansas.
Okay, some good stuff. That is all on the way here on the Mighty 690. We have 26 degrees right now as we approach 757. Back here at 810 on the Mighty 690, we continue our chat with the folks from K-State Research and Extension's Wildcat District. Joining us, we have Horticulture Agent Jesse Gilmore. Good morning once again, Jesse.
Good morning.
Hey, it's good to have you on here. And I know we've had some recent headlines and brushed on it just ever so slightly during some recent segments, but that's the fact that the hardiness zone here for our area has had a few changes.
Yeah, so historically, the USDA is responsible for tracking weather data and its implications for agricultural production. And one of the ways they do that is the hardiness zone. Now, hardiness zone, for most agricultural crops, is not going to matter all that much because a lot of crops you're growing in the summer when the winter hardiness is not going to matter. With things like winter wheat, it might be more of an issue. But for the hardiness zone, a lot of the time it's going to be more relevant to horticultural plants, especially perennials that you are expecting to come back year after year. The last hardiness zone map update that they did was in 2012, and after 11 years of data collection from over 30,000 different weather stations across the U.S., they did a sweeping update of hardiness zones based on that data, and about half of Kansas to two-thirds of Kansas jumped up half a hardiness zone. So instead of 6B in southeast Kansas like we used to be, we are now in zone 7A, which is a problem for Zone 6 Garden Club in Pittsburgh because their name is now kind of inaccurate. Of course, they were formed when we were zone 6, but they might need to update their name a little bit.
Now, what actually is the definition of a hardiness zone? Is this related to like first frost dates? I mean, how does this kind of play in?
So it is cold hardiness. What the hardiness zone looks at, and it goes back through data at these different weather stations, and it determines the minimum temperature that you reached at any point during the winter. And what it does is it compiles an average over a certain amount of time, and it gives you the average lowest temperature you can expect. So you've got plants, and they have a cold tolerance to them relative to their native range, typically. So tropical plants are not going to take frost or cold temperatures very well. More temperate plants, even boreal and arctic plants, are going to take very good cold temperatures. So one good example of a hardiness zone extreme is the honeyberry, also known as the Haxap, H-A-K-S-A-P. It is a fruiting variety of honeysuckle that is native down to zone 2 in Alaska. So it is very, very cold tolerant, and that's because it is native to Siberia over in Russia. So the native range is going to determine a lot about what plants you can grow. Like, you need a basic understanding of where the plants are from, essentially. I always say, for hardiness zone temperatures, it's an average. So half of the years you can expect the coldest temperature to be colder than the average, and half of the years you can expect it to be warmer. The USDA felt confident that 11 years of data at these different 11 years of data at 30,000 different stations across the United States is a lot of data to sift through. So they have a very good amount of information to make these decisions about updating the map. And we had a professor from K-State actually sit on the steering committee for making these changes. And she's in the horticulture department. So we do have some local input on that decision. So that's nice. But when you're buying a plant, you always want to plan for usually one zone colder than what you have on average. So now that we're zone 7, any plant labeled as hardy to zone 6 would likely work. Yes, hardy to zone 6. So
as the numbers go up, it's basically warmer in general.
Yes, as the numbers go up on the label of the plant is going to need warmer winters. Now, there are ways to get around cold temperatures, and it involves putting the plant in the right spot in the garden. There's the microclimate of your garden. Microclimate just describes the atmosphere immediately surrounding your ground level, essentially. And there are ways to make the spot that you put your plant warmer than it typically would be. Usually, if you're planting on the south side of your house, that's going to get a lot more direct sunlight. And if your house is brick, for example, my house is brick, it reflects a lot of heat back towards the ground.
It could store that up in the energy in the bricks there, and they kind of reflect it.
Yeah, it's reflective, and it's also absorbing that heat. So the south side of my house is a lot warmer than especially the north side, because you're not getting hardly any direct sunlight on the north side of your house in the winter, because the sun is lower in the sky as the earth tilts away from the, or as our side of the, or the northern hemisphere tilts away from the sun. So not putting plants in low spots in your garden, because that's where cold air accumulates. There can be as much as a 5-degree difference between low spots and higher spots in your garden. Even if the low spot is maybe 6 inches lower, it's kind of insane how much of a difference that can make in cooling the colder air.
Oh yeah, I've seen just kind of walking down in kind of, you know, drainage, like kind of dry creeks or whatever, you know, if I'm walking out and about, especially you notice, I seem to notice it more around evening. But yeah, you'll walk down into kind of a little valley and you can feel it, the temperature drop. I don't know how perceptive we are degree changes, but I mean, you could feel it.
Yeah, so I wouldn't necessarily recommend putting zone 7 and up plants in the ground necessarily. You know, you're gonna have better luck, assuming you remember to bring them in, putting them in some kind of container that's portable and you can move inside and outside as necessary. But anything labeled for zone 6 hardiness and lower should do fine in our climate now. That only applies to perennials or woody plants. Annual plants, obviously, they are going to die off at the end of the growing season. They're not going to try surviving throughout the winter. Now, some perennials, like crepe myrtle, they will die back to the ground, but the roots are still alive, and they should resprout in the spring. Crepe myrtle, in warmer climates, it's a tree. Here, it is a dieback and regrowth shrub. We're about as far north as crepe myrtles can grow. We're about as far north as pecans can grow. There's plenty of trees, or there's plenty of plants that have a more, a warmer need, essentially. But with the right variety selection, you can get some more cold-tolerant plants as well. So when you're at the garden center, you can look on the label. Usually, almost always, it will tell you the winter hardiness zone that it's adapted to. One thing that is gaining more traction but is not quite as common as I would like to see yet is the AHS heat zone that it is adapted to. So AHS is the American Horticultural Society. They are starting to label more plants for heat tolerance as well. And that is very helpful, especially this past year when it got really hot and really dry. So what that does is it maps the number of days where the high temperature is over 86 during the year, and it aggregates them. So as you go farther south, obviously you're going to have a higher zone because you have more days over 86. It can get pretty crazy as far as some of the most southerly regions of the United States.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've been in Arizona where once they pretty much start consistently hitting over 100, they stay over 100 every day until, like, September.
Yeah, I think there was, like, a streak of over a month where the high was over 110.
That's wild.
But we don't have to deal with that, luckily. We just... We are much lower in the number. It's interesting because the AHS heat zone map, it's not measuring the maximum temperature like the hardiness zone or the USDA hardiness zone map does. It's measuring an aggregation. So the plants that are more adapted to higher zones, you're not probably going to need to water as much. Obviously, all plants need water to some extent, even succulents like cactuses, but if you see that in a garden center, I don't remember what zone we are, and I probably should have looked that up when we were on break, but that is more information for understanding how adaptable that plant is going to be to our area. And it's important, it's I think becoming increasingly more important to understand how climate is going to impact your plants, because the climate is just getting more and more extreme. I wouldn't necessarily say I'm a bit skeptical on that we are just getting warmer across the board, but you can definitely see higher highs and lower lows. So the pendulum of climate extremes is getting more and more intense.
It looks like for our area, we're kind of between what they have is zone 7 and 8.
Okay,
so it's kind of half and half. It's split kind of along extreme eastern Kansas and then kind of southern Kansas.
And does it say how many days we can expect as far as that heat zone?
Yeah, so it looks like we've got for the zone 7, it's really small here, it's going to be between 50 and 60, I think.
Really? 50 and 60, okay.
It's really small. I need to get a bigger size of this.
Yeah,
I think I'm reading
and
it wrong.
Just like with the USDA map, AHS is also going to a lot of effort to keep that as updated as possible using the same data.
And 8 is 90 to 120.
90 days, yeah. So
and I think it's 7 is 60 to 90.
Okay, so there's quite a difference between zones for AHS, and that's because they are combining... They're not picking one temperature. They're combining all of the days. So, yeah, you're not as likely to see that zone on garden center labels and plants that you might want to buy. But it is becoming more common as people understand that water is becoming a very serious issue, and so is drought. So understanding how your plant is going to interact with heat when it does arrive, because it will help you understand how much input you're going to need to put into those plants to keep them alive. If anyone does have any questions on hardiness zone related stuff, or be that heat or winter hardiness, you can always give our office a call and I can get your specific info and figure out what plants might work best, because not all plants are created equal when it comes to cold and heat tolerance.
No, that is a great reminder there, Jesse. So I know also you have a few events that are coming up. Do you want to hit on some of those?
Yeah, so we have the last garden hour of the year today from noon to 1. Because we are in the winter, we are using this opportunity to cover a little bit more niche of a topic when it comes to horticulture. They're actually going to be covering some basics to beekeeping. So if you've ever been interested in starting a hive or want to learn more about what goes into beekeeping, that webinar would be worth attending. Bees are very, very important pollinators for pretty much all of the plants we've got. I think about 70% of our food supply just from honeybees alone. So making sure that honeybees can stay healthy and supported at a local level is very important. I know we have a Montgomery County Beekeepers Association. They asked me to come out and sit on a panel at one point. Their honey was very tasty.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, beekeeping increasingly is getting more visibility as a hobby.
It really is.
So, yeah, if you are interested in getting any information about beekeeping, tune into the Garden Hour today at noon.
That's very cool. That's good. It's going to be a good event there. And yeah, I mean, there was a time when almost every farmer did have a hive of some sort. So it's kind of cool seeing us get a little bit back to that and just see some of these backyard beekeepers as well.
Oh, for sure. And James has done quite a lot of classes on beekeeping, mostly with kids. They love learning about honeybees, and they do something called the waggle dance every time they teach about pollinators. I'm not sure exactly what that entails because I've never seen it before. I've just heard stories. But kids in particular, that's one of the first pollinators they zone in on. A lot of people don't know honeybees aren't actually native to the United States.
Which is wild.
They're native to Europe. They're arguably the most successful introduced species of all time. But yeah, play a huge ecological role, want to keep them healthy and happy if possible. So beekeeping will definitely be a big part of that.
Yeah, it's not like the other bees, they don't produce enough honey. They just do it for themselves, right? I mean, they don't.
Yeah, and pollinators, native pollinators, like bees, native bees, for example, like mason bees, they are just as numerous as honeybees are, but they don't do nearly as much of the pollination. And a lot of them are going to be solitary. They're not going to form hives like honeybees will. They're not social insects. But they are also important to support. And actually, that does bring up one final point that I'd like to mention. If you haven't cleaned up your garden for the winter, you might leave stems and other debris in your garden over the winter, especially stems, because stems play an important role in native pollinator overwintering. So they will lay their eggs inside the dead stems of plants like hydrangeas, and then the eggs will emerge in the spring. And if you cut the stems out early and discard them, you're removing habitat for native pollinators. So if you did want to support pollinators, obviously there is a balance between supporting pollinators and having an aesthetically pleasing landscape. And that's a balance that you would need to think about.
Hey, well, here's your excuse, you know, to be able to not have to clean everything up completely.
Oh, yes. I mean, immediately, and that's the key, because you will need to do that in the spring before things start sprouting again.
You can kick the can down the road, though. I'm fine with that.
Oh, yeah, I am too. I definitely am. But that's one way that, even if you didn't want to be a beekeeper full-time, you could still support pollinators.
Hey, we like that. Well, Jesse, if people have questions for you on this or any horticulture related topic, how can we get a hold of you?
Gerard office, 620-724-8233, or my email address, jr637@ksu.edu.
Excellent. Well, Jesse, appreciate you coming on by. Have a great rest of your day. We'll look forward to chatting again real soon.
All right. Sounds good. You too.
All right. That is Jesse Gilmore, K-State Research and Extension's Wildcat District. And coming up, we have Candy Westbrook in studio here in just a few moments. An early bird edition of Open Line is up next. 27 degrees at 827.